So we're back, folks. Part two. This is our new format. So give us feedback. Hop on to Facebook. I'll tell you where all those things, the Twitter, the Instagram. Just let us know what you think of the format. And during our break, we actually had some interesting discussions about some things around intelligence and counterintelligence and stuff like that. There's just some interesting stuff out there. We're swapping books back and forth. And so, there's just some people do stupid shit. Which what makes your job interesting, right? Especially mm-hmm. when you decided that you wanted to go. So let me ask you this. What made you decide, or how did the process come about? Because you went to Cal DOJ in 94. And as we were talking, we were sharing names, and we have a name in common, Ed Manavian. And so, Steve, when I was doing my work down at US DOJ on information intelligence sharing, one of the reps we had from California was from Cal DOJ. And I said, what's Ed Manavian? Well, so Terry Gill, tell him, Gary, who was Ed Manavian to you?
Well, Ed Manavian, when I first met him, he was a supervisor at B&E in Riverside, and he's a character. He's a pretty funny guy. He's a great guy. And after 9/11, the Attorney General Bill Lockyer decided that California needed its own organic counterterrorism intelligence collection organization. And so he tapped Ed Manavian to be the chief, and Ed tapped me to be the task force commander to stand up the task force in Southern California. I had Monterey to San Diego. So I owe cool. Ed a lot, but I also, he's a great guy. He's a really good guy.
And so we were just talking about we were talking about it's a small world, right? We're all related by 2 degrees of separation. I may not know somebody, but I know somebody who knows you, or, you know, et cetera.
It's amazing. It's amazing. And, you know, and it sounds like it was kind of, I don't know, I hate to say this, that you patterned it after NYPD, New York PD, but, you know, they got agents or police officers stationed all around the world. They've got officers in Israel. They've got them in the UK.
That's right.
We even had one, a DEA Special Operations Division, permanently assigned there. It's a great tactic.
Well, you know what? I mean, when you're a city, you know, the size of New York, with the New York is a center of gravity for the United States. Los Angeles is also, but New York is a center of gravity for the United States in terms of the economy, et cetera. You have to do these things. You have to put, as we all know, intelligence is the key to combating terrorism. And you got to have people out there. You can't just sit around and wait for crumbs to drop from the federal agencies. You got to get out there. And LAPD has also been historically very aggressive in intelligence collection and analysis also. And they have presence outside the borders of the city of Los Angeles as well. They had people in D.C. and at the National Counterterrorism Center and other places. And I worked with NYPD Intelligence Division a couple of times, and got shown around the city by one of their detectives, which was great fun. And yeah. I have tremendous respect for their operation. And I know John Miller, who was the chief of intelligence at NYPD and was an ABC correspondent.
I was about to say, I've met him. I lectured up at the NY State Police Intelligence Conference. Steve, John Miller, he was the guy who got the interview with Osama bin Laden.
That's right. That's right.
Wow.
He is a true believer. And I had a great working relationship with him, and, because we were kind of the new guys on the block, in terms of the counterterrorism intelligence thing. And John was brought in post 9/11, and, I have nothing but respect for him. He really, he's one of the good guys.
He brought a unique view to it. One of the things I liked about John is he brought a unique view to it. He didn't bring in a law enforcement background. I mean, You think of this. Here's a guy who found bin Laden as a news reporter when all the intelligence, where is this guy? He finds him and interviews him.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, hey, we had the guy that pulled
Saddam Hussein out of the hole.
Yeah, out of the damn hole.
Kevin Holland.
Kevin Holland.
we know people on this podcast. We know people.
That's right.
Hey, but I got to ask you one question though. Well, look, let's put this in perspective because I do want to talk about your work on the terrorism. But look, you said like maybe New York was maybe the one side of it. But when I think of the United States, if I'm attacking something on the East Coast, yeah, New York is the top target. But if I'm thinking of the West Coast, LA is the top target. I mean, guys were top targets for terrorism, top targets because of the economy. And so, yeah, having to build your own capability, I mean, that's just like, it seems like a duh, but it's not that easy to do, right? I mean, it takes a lot of work. And during that time, did you ever know Rich Moraz over at LAPD?
What was the name, Rich?
Rich Moraz. He was the commander at Rampart when the whole Rampart scandal went down.
No,
was doing a lot of anti-terrorism stuff, I think, with the Olympics and stuff. So I didn't know if you guys ever crossed paths.
No, I don't believe so.
That's it. I mean, there was, you guys were building up to that. So talk about your transition then from, not transition, but Cal DOJ, but how did you end up getting involved with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which really took on a bigger role, obviously, after 9/11. So before 9/11, you had the JTTFs, but they weren't as big of a deal.
Right.
In 99.
Correct. I'll backpedal and say that I've always been fascinated by the subject of two subjects. Espionage, the world of espionage and counterintelligence and terrorism. And going back to the 80s and the Olympics in Los Angeles. And so I've kind of always been fascinated by that and had the opportunity when one of our agents was departing to, because I already had the necessary clearances because I'd been working with the Bureau on public corruption cases and other things. So I was working intelligence, and so I asked for that billet and went to the Joint Terrorism Task Force in 99 and was assigned to Domestic Terrorism Squad. And that was where most of the locals were on the Domestic Terrorism Squad.
Now, you were still a Cal DOJ employee at that time, right?
Agent. Yes, I was a special agent, yeah.
Why not just a regular agent? Why did you have to be a special agent?
Well, that's what they called us. I don't know.
Well, that's what they call anybody that wasn't a trooper, because you do have investigative abilities.
Can you imagine how, hi, I'm not just trooper, but I'm special trooper, right? I bet you are.
Yeah, yes, you are.
I think that went back to J. Edgar. He wanted to distinguish themselves. We just weren't going to be agents. The FBI was going to be special agents,
yeah. Yeah,
because you had railroad agents, you had other agents. Hey, you know that. Yeah, look at it, Murph. He's shaking his head. Go, yeah, whatever. You know.
Now I got asked. I was on the witness stand in Miami at one time in a trial, and defense attorney asked me, "What's your title?" And I told him, "Special agent." He's like, "What makes you so special?" And I was ready to answer, the prosecutor objected, and the judge jumped out of his chair and told the defense attorney, "Go sit down." I didn't get a chance.
Well, let me ask you this. Agent Murphy, what was going to be your answer if I said, what makes you so special?
I said, let me just slap you one time and see how special you think that is. No, I'm joking, everybody. Just joking here.
Yeah. In federal district court. Yeah. Good luck with that.
Yeah. Yeah, he's joking. He wouldn't have slapped him one time. He would have slapped him three or four times. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Before the marshals grabbed me and threw me to the ground.
Yeah.
But boy, wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, that bam. One of the things, if I kind of just get away with it, you know, I'd take, look what, it would have been a misdemeanor at the most, right? Pay a fine, you know. I would take the misdemeanor.
That would have been a career move.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, but imagine real quickly though, suppose you had secretly won the lottery and you could have just told everybody, hey, fuck off. I can do whatever I want. You would have done that, wouldn't you? If you knew you had $10 million waiting for you when this was all over, it was worth it.
I tell you what, man, I love being a cop so much. I don't think I could have done it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, back to our that was a digression. So in our drinking game, that's digression number two. Back to our regularly scheduled podcast.
It's number one into this part, but it's number two for both parts.
See, I'm keeping track of everything of overall, right? So it's but in any event, you're taking a drink. So, woo-hoo. But back to you there, Gary, our special, not just a guest, but a special guest.
Yes.
Our special guest. Special agent, special guest, special K. So let's talk about this. So what kind of things, what were the big cases before 9/11, but what were the things you were working on from a domestic terrorism that were of interest to the state of California? What was getting your attention?
Well, in actual fact,
Is there any other kind of facts if they're not actual facts?
Well,
you can slap me when you see
made up facts. I mean, are these made up facts? I'm sorry, it's like a defense attorney would do. Oh, an actual fact. Where are they, what other kind of facts are there? But anyway, I'm just kidding. But in actuality, yes.
Right. Well, in actuality, we had a few groups that were. Domestic terrorist groups, theoretically, potentially, that we monitored, but it wasn't directly. More about me being there. Was more about the state of California or the Department of Justice having a seat there than it was about me doing something specific for the Department of Justice in terms of you know, a specific target that I was working on under the auspices of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. I was assisting with investigations that were ongoing involving different types of targets that were, one involved individuals who potentially were going to you know, or had placed a bomb somewhere, and they were kind of a radical religious group, and things like that. There was nothing there that was like super exciting or interesting in terms of what was happening. They had a domestic terrorism squad. There were things going on. People were working on them, but. It wasn't like what was happening on the international side.
I don't want to say until 9/11, you know, things changed, obviously, but was there anything that was going on during that time that caused you concern about something coming up? I mean, were you hearing chatter? Because look, we had the bombings in Nairobi and Tanzania. You had the embassy bombings. Al-Qaeda was becoming bigger on the scene now. I mean, they were becoming a threat. Clinton was trying to go after bin Laden, you know, trying to hunt him down. Was any of that stuff affecting you in California at that time?
Well, I was aware of it, was hearing about bin Laden and other things. I'm not sure that all of those things were really being taken seriously back then. You'll recall that, I can't remember the gentleman's name. The bin Laden group at the agency was called the family. Because they were kind of like off off by themselves someplace. You know what I'm talking about.
I think the official name was called Alex Station. A guy named Michael Schur was the intelligence.
Exactly. But they called it Alex Station, but they also called them like the family, like the Manson family or something in a way. It was pejorative, you know. And the signs were there everywhere. In bold letters, it was like a billboard on Sunset Boulevard, but nobody was paying attention to the billboards. Like you said, we had Tanzania and Nairobi, we had Pent Bomb, the World Trade Center attack, which, you know, people don't realize that that could have very easily been. An unbelievably devastating attack had the bomb been sufficiently engineered and placed correctly. I don't want to say too much, but my understanding from people is that, you know, it could have dropped a tower and potentially dropped two towers.
And in the trial, that's where some of the conjecture is about how did bin Laden and ISIS, you know, and Al-Qaeda learn, I should say, about what to do next time, because a lot of information came out in the trial in terms of what was it structurally designed to withstand the impact of a 737. You know, these things were all put into the public. By the way, here's an interesting part too. The way they caught these guys, because they recovered the VIN number off the van like they did with Timothy McVeigh. And you know what these idiots did? They went back to try to claim, hey, our Ryder truck was stolen. And they were waiting there for him and nabbed him.
That's right. That's exactly correct. And, they do dumb stuff. And thank God they do. because if they didn't do dumb stuff, we'd probably be in a far greater world of hurt. But they also have some very intelligent, sophisticated people that are extremely dangerous and continue to be so. So we cannot dismiss them as being a bunch of fools. They're deadly serious, and they have long memories, and they're not likely to go away anytime soon.
Yeah. Episode 11, we had two of my friends from the Counterterrorism Command, New Scotland Yard, that worked the 7705 train bombings.
Oh, yeah.
And then the follow-up bombing. A lot of people don't realize there were actually two attacks. The second one fizzled out because, thankfully, these guys weren't as bright as the first ones, who unfortunately pulled it off.
Was that the one where they had the bomb at outside a discotheque in London, central London, and then they ended up at Glasgow?
No, that's a different one.
Okay.
This one was a close call.
Whew.
Yeah, a lot of these were close calls. In fact, the follow-on attack to the 7705 train bombings fizzled because one of the bombs fizzled out. They didn't make they were using hydrogen peroxide, TATP, and didn't have it set. And the other thing, too, that was funny is one of the ladies that they went to interview called in to complain. She complained because somebody parked in her space, and it was one of the bombers from the second attack. But like you're saying, fortunately, we don't get but they're thinking differently than we are about the problem. And that's why they thought differently about how to use planes. But I agree with you. I think out of that thing, they learned a lot of lessons out of that one, which is it's got to be something bigger. They weren't going to get a second shot. You know why? Because they made it virtually impossible to bring anything into the basement of the World Trade Center, you know, 1 and 2, without it being scanned and checked. They learned the lessons. But what lesson did we learn? We're always fighting yesterday's wars. Nobody was really thinking about what's coming next.
That's
what's
human
coming
nature.
Next was airplanes. Yeah.
You know, the history of mankind, we always seem to be fighting the last war.
Well, let's talk about the turning point for you, because everybody's got their stories. So many people we've talked to that we didn't realize had stories around 9/11. Obviously, our friends in New York, we had Zach on, Murph, you know, and we didn't realize how close he was in New York City at the DEA office, not too far from that when it was going on.
Just on his day.
Yeah. Let's talk about you, though, with 9/11, because that changed the op tempo, that changed fundamentally the mission of the JTTF. What happened?
I actually had promoted in January of 2001 into internal affairs. And so I maintained a sort of quasi-liaison role, but my primary mission was internal affairs cases right up until September of 2001. I was actually in a training school in Sacramento on 9/11 and woke up that morning and saw the flames coming out of the building and Katie Couric saying, you know, it looks like there's a really bad fire in the Trade Center. And I'm going, I don't know about that. It looks a little worse than just a fire, you know? And of course the rest is history. And for the next 4 or 5 days, we were all glued to the TVs in between breaks in the class and everything. And then Ed called me up and asked me if I wanted to, told me about what they were doing and asked me if I wanted to be part of it. And I said, hell yes.
Well, not that internal affairs we've talked about is a necessary thing. You have to do it right. But I mean, but this was your chance to get back in the game, get in the mission.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What did you end up doing?
In terms of standing up the task force? Well,
what was your new mission? When Ed brought you back, what did he want you to do?
Come up with a task force and come up with recruit people. My immediate boss, the special agent in charge in LA that I was working for, John Kenny, we all put our heads together to try and figure out where we can recruit agents or officers and from other agencies. We had a highway patrol officer. We had a detective and a sergeant from another South Bay city, and actually two South Bay cities, now that I think about it. And we had liaison from Ventura and Santa Barbara counties and Orange County until they stood up a task force in Orange County. And one of the big things that we did was pick identify candidates that we needed for analysts. That was one of the things that I really think is so important. Intelligence analysis is critical because you have to make sense of all this stuff because there's loads and loads of information coming in and it's just white noise unless somebody can sit down and slog through it and make sense of it and connect the dots so that the trigger pullers and the knuckle draggers and the collectors can get out in the field and do their jobs. They need that. And our role was specifically to be an intelligence clearinghouse for other agencies. We weren't really going to be doing criminal cases ourselves. We were strictly an intelligence collection and an analysis unit, and we had our agents peace officers, our collectors, were building cases that we would hand off to sister agencies like LAPD and the Sheriff's Department and the FBI and other agencies that had, you know, and that's what we did. We basically put together cases, got them ready, packaged them up, and handed them off to other agencies. So we would stay clean and remain in an intelligence collection function.
So you were kind of operating as a deconfliction center as well, right?
Well, not really. Well, kind of in a way, but we did have a deconfliction component because we also stood up an intelligence clearinghouse in Sacramento that was staffed 24/7. We had some tremendous analysts up there working. So that became a deconfliction center in a sense. But we also work very close with LA Clear, which is the deconfliction center in LA. Because my boss, John, was also the boss of LA Clear. And that was a big part of it. But the biggest part of it was the analytical component. You know, I was lucky enough to have a native Farsi speaker assigned to me, and she was an incredible resource, that's a really important thing to have when you're talking about Los Angeles with the largest Iranian expat community in outside of Tehran, and that's a really good thing, and so we had that, and we had other things that really helped us a lot.
I didn't know LA had that large of a community.
Oh, yeah. It's huge. It's huge.
So I grew up 3 years in Iran during the days of the Shah. My first foreign language I spoke was Farsi.
Oh, there you go.
But Khoda Hafez.
I was going to say Khoda Hafez. I don't know much.
Right. Up y'all's too.
First of all, what the hell is that?
Not translated. Up yours as well. You know.
Yeah, that's not up yours. It's not. But. So there is but you're working a lot of that though, but it's very unique though, because as you move forward in time, what possessed you to say, hey, there's a lot of bombs going off. There's a lot of shooting going off, a lot of bad things happening over in this place. Oh, it's called Iraq. I'd like to go to Iraq. I mean, don't you get that on a typical afternoon in LA?
Yeah, well, not quite the same. It's definitely not quite
the
same.
It's more dangerous than Iraq, isn't it? Yeah.
Actually, yeah, the 405 freeway is definitely more dangerous than Iraq was. In actual fact, the thing was I was nearing my retirement, and I was looking for something to do, and I wanted to stay in the game. And I wanted to go to town and see the elephant. Basically, I wanted to go to the belly of the beast. Middle Eastern terrorism has been something or terrorism in general was basically something that was happening most of the time in other places. And I kind of wanted to get a sense of what it was really all about up close and personal. I applied to this outfit and was accepted and retired.
Well, wait a minute. Well, anytime this outfit, all right, let's be What can you say about this outfit? Because I know one of the ones is called Jido. That was one of the ones dealing with the IED stuff. So were you DOD? Were you IC? Where were you at?
I was... I was embedded. I got to be careful with you. You're a trained interrogator. I was embedded with... IED defeat intelligence cell in Baghdad with 10th Mountain.
Yeah.
Climb to glory.
Well, and funny you should mention that too, because that's JIDO was the organization I was talking about, the Joint IED. And I knew some, defeat. And that was a huge, I mean, tell us people, just reground us on why that was such an important mission, because why was that such an important mission?
Well, because I believe, I don't know the statistics, but I mean, certainly from the anecdotal evidence that I saw, most all of the casualties were being produced by improvised explosive devices, whether they are HME homemade explosives or repurposed artillery rounds or mines or stuff that came in from other places, EFPs, all of it. And, when you look at the evolution of vehicles in that war, they start out with soft skinned, 1151 Humvees, and you end up with up armored Humvees with doors that are 6 inches or 3 inches thick and glass and all kinds of other stuff. And then, and also V-hold mine resistant vehicles, MRAPs and JIRVs and all of those things and all kinds of other stuff to, countermeasures, that they had to prevent these weapons from being detonated remotely.
One question for you, Gary. You mentioned EFPs, and we asked that you describe all your acronyms there.
What's EFP? I don't know if you can do MIRV, GIRVs, swerves, and
Well, read the book. It's in the book, actually. No, but an EFP is an explosively formed projectile, and it basically utilizes a copper plate that is cone-shaped, and upon detonation of the warhead, it's aimed like a round would be aimed. It forms a superheated jet of copper material that literally penetrates through the armor of a vehicle and causes utter devastation inside the vehicle. It's been a long time since I studied these things, so I'm sort of like going off the top of my head about, but they are, shape charges are nothing new. They go back to World War II and probably before World War II. But this was a new wrinkle because it was a specifically designed charge that used a copper plate that was shaped in a concave disc.
Yeah, it helps you focus the direction of the explosive.
This is going to shock you, Murph, but Gary, where did all these insurgents in Iraq, where did they learn about EFPs, and who was maybe the one country behind bringing a lot of those into the country?
I'll give you one clue. Hoda Hafez.
Hoda, Iran, the Quds Force.
That's right.
Iran, they have been involved in killing American soldiers. And by the way, I can't not mention this too, because one of the guys I used to work with, his son, who is a friend of mine, was killed in Mosul, Iraq on August 1st, 2007. He was with one of the security forces, Kansas Army National Guard, was killed by an IED.
Yeah.
Sergeant Travis Bachman and his dad, Rodney Bachman, just passed away here recently. But yeah, it's we were in Baltimore, and a good friend of my wife's, we were in Baltimore at a APCO conference, the Association of Public Safety Communicators, when they got the news that day that he had been killed in that attack, because both his mother and father worked at the police department.
Yeah, I I used to see the images when they would come to come to our cell of the aftermath of these attacks, and it's not pretty. Not pretty at all.
It leaves a lasting effect, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it does. And it, when you look at the mine resistant MRAP, mine resistant and ambush protected. That's what it means. Mine resistant ambush protected vehicles. I mean, they're not built for the conventional battlefield. They're tall. They're huge targets. They're easy to shoot at. But when you're dealing with a counterinsurgency situation where your opponent, you know, is not playing according to the rules and, you know, bearing, you know, these devices on the roadways, you have to have a V-hull to deflect the blast away from the hull. And of course, that's the genesis of these vehicles.
One of the guys I knew actually was a barista, believe it or not, at Starbucks, but he always wanted to do something different. He ended up working for a company that were doing a lot of the up armoring and the MRAP stuff. There is a place over in West Virginia, Murph, where you just don't get in Humvee and say, hey, let's up armor it. They had to actually take people over to a course because all the vehicle dynamics change once you start adding all of this weight and everything. They had to learn how to drive it, how to maneuver it differently. It's not just a Humvee, you know, like you say, thin skin, you know.
Your center of gravity changes and that thing will flip over in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And go ahead.
No, I was going to say, tell us now about getting into Iraq. So you join this thing. It's one thing to learn about it, but it's another thing to get deployed. So you go now from being Manhattan Beach, you know, being Beverly Hills. This has to be a sharp contrast with Beverly Hills, right?
yeah.
Where do I park my Mercedes at? Is there a valet here?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, having never been in the service, it was just a tiny, tiny bit of a shock to be suddenly thrust into the world of the United States Army, and the world of the United States Army that is deployed is even more of a shock to that the delicate sensibilities of a civilian cop.
Hold on though. I got to ask you one question though. How did that conversation go with your wife? Cause I can't imagine she was going, hey, is this this sounds like a good idea.
Hey, honey.
Well, you know, my wife,
I told you I wanted you to do something. I just didn't say go to Iraq to do that.
Exactly. She knew that I was sort of a true believer in this whole world of counterterrorism and that this is what and my wife is tremendously supportive. She's been incredibly supportive of me throughout my entire career, through all of the things, through narcotics and having babies and, you know, that world. I mean, you know, you're never home and you're on surveillance all the time and you're in all that other stuff. And she has always been 1,000% behind me. And I know that, you know, based on what she's told me and what other people have told me. I mean, she was scared to death the whole time I was gone. And because, you know, she was in the news business, and she would be involved with reporting on these stories, not report as a reporter, but producing these stories, you know, coming out of Iraq about, you know, X number of soldiers killed and things like that. The truth is that I never heard a hostile shot fired. I heard lots of happy fire. I saw lots of happy fire. And in 2008, things had calmed down pretty dramatically. It wasn't 2004, 2005, you know, 2006, where things were pretty wild. And at least in my experience, which was pretty much, I did leave the, I left Victory Base, which is where I worked. Originally I was supposed to go to a unit that was in Sadr City. And unfortunately they saw that I'd been a task force commander. So they pulled me off of that assignment, which I really was actually anxious to do, and put me in charge of a bunch of other LEPs, which what we were called, and put me in charge of a bunch of other ones.
What does that stand for?
Law enforcement professional.
Leps.
Yeah. And put me
good
in charge.
Good thing it wasn't
of
law enforcement professionals retired. That would have been a leper then, right?
Exactly.
thank you.
So I was, oversaw the operations of a bunch of other guys that are spread out through southern Iraq. In addition to my duties with the intelligence cell.
So what were your duties to the extent you can disclose those things? I mean, what were you there to do?
I was there primarily to provide them, as you know, the war had devolved an asymmetric counterinsurgency war and had many aspects that are similar to dealing with organized crime organizations and narcotics trafficking organizations in terms of the similarities in their modus operandi and that kind of thing. And so that was one of the things that I was brought in to lend my expertise to. And not only that, though, at that point in time, the coalition forces had to utilize the Iraqi justice system. So that meant that and had to bring along Iraqi army, Iraqi police on operations. So that meant that now you have GIs having to do evidence collection and things that normally a police officer does, now combat soldiers are having to do, and they're not really trained up for it. So that was one of the other things that I did. So I lended that my perspective on that. I wrote a paper on how to process a shooting scene, a sniper shooting scene, what to look for, what kind of evidence is important, how to safeguard the evidence so it's not contaminated, because we did have DNA labs. We had very sophisticated labs over there, and we had access to other labs back at Quantico. And also we had asset forfeiture, because as we all know, money is what makes the world go around and helps criminal organizations operate. And these bombings were frequently more of a money making venture than an ideological adventure. And so when you take their money, or you find out who is Daddy Warbucks who's financing it, you can make things very difficult for them to operate, as you well know. And so that was one of the other things that I worked on with a colleague, and then he left and I finished the deal where a procedure was created for the collection of funds when they're encountered during a raid.
Wow. I go back to episode 56. We had one of the guys who became a friend of ours, but you met him at a conference, Jeff Sandy. Jeff was an IRS agent that went over to Iraq. And you know what? He ended up interviewing and debriefing Tariq Aziz to drill down on all of the seized assets, the oil for food scam that was going on. That was part of his job to see is from a different aspect, but where's the money going? And how do we recover these billions and billions of dollars that Saddam and his sons and the other folks had stolen and pilfered from the country?
I actually liaisoned with some IRS agents, CID agents over there when I was trying to come up with this proposal.
I'll tell you what, when you're going after the financial side of it, there's no better investigators there.
That's right.
The IRS.
Yeah.
They're top notch.
Yep, they are. They are. Boy, they definitely put the fear of God in a subject when you find out the IRS is coming after you. It may take them a while, but boy, when they come, it's not good.
Don't you guys just love it in the mail when you walk out there and there's that envelope and it's that distinctive envelope that says Internal Revenue Service and you're going, do I want to open this or not?
You don't want to, but you better.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, remember, Al Capone went to jail, not for killing people.
Go. Exactly.
There you go. Evading taxes. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right now, I'm kind of avoiding those or dreading getting those from the Wisconsin Department of taxation.
Why?
It's just anything that has tax on it. Well, we made money in there in 2019, and then you know, we haven't since, but they're trying to charge me tax for 2020 and they want to add a $13,000 tax bill and, you know, late payment.
What?
We've got it down to a couple hundred bucks, but now we're, you know, trying to get rid of that. It's just continues on and on and on. I have to say, though, they're nice about it.
Well, that's good. Like, that's good.
Kiss you on the cheek before they shove it up your, you know what.
And we didn't think you were going to get a happy ending out of this one, Murph.
Here we are digressing.
Digressing. There's the third digression. Back to your drinking game. Taking a shot. Two for this episode. So what I want to do is kind of drill down on that because we want to leave some time, too, to talk about your book. But you did this. You worked on this. And like I said, in 2008, that's when you deployed. How long did you do this? Because you also ended up, what's unique too, you came back though to California, but then you couldn't stay away. You ended up going to SOCOM. You ended up going down to Tampa. So talk about how long were you in Iraq and what kind of things did you do ultimately before you ended up coming back to the U.S.?
I was in Iraq for five and a half months. And I came back. And I tested and got hired by another outfit and was going to do something even more interesting. But unfortunately, I discovered that I needed a hip replacement. So that ruined that. So I was on the beach for about a year after I came back.
But tell people when we say on the beach, we don't like, I mean, you mean there's, you're around a beach, but when you mean on the beach, what do you mean by that from a contracting standpoint?
Well, euphemistically, I mean that I was basically at home, which is actually when I started writing the book in 2009. But, and then I got hired, actually, the progression is I got hired to work as an investigator. Analyst, intelligence analyst, terrorism guy on the detainee cases, the military commissions cases. And then I did that. And then
did
I had
you travel down to, did you get a chance to go to Gitmo?
Yes, I did. I went to.
How was that experience flying into Cuba?
It was very interesting. I was talking to somebody the other day about this, and I'm still not sure which side of the island is the island that you fly into. It's windward or leeward. But there's an airstrip. There's a naval air station on one side of the island. And you fly into there, and we would fly commercial out of Andrews, okay? Which was also interesting because I used to see Air Force One all the time when I'd fly down to – which is kind of cool. You know, that's pretty cool. And then fly down commercial to Guantanamo and then take a Navy contract barge – basically across the bay to the other side where the courtrooms and the commissaries and the bars and all the fun stuff is on the other side of the island. And it's really fascinating. It was a very interesting place, a very historical place. I'm a historian guy and there are remnants of the Spanish-American War and, you know, old battleship moles all over the harbor and just really, it was a cool place. And the tiki bar was fun, very fun, and the food was not awful, and we stayed in the bachelor officer's quarters, so the quarters were good. It was just a very, very interesting experience, really fascinating experience.
They had commercial flights flying to Gitmo?
Yeah, yeah. It was commercial flights because you had all these civilians flying over there, most of them reporters. From all over the world, basically, flying to Guantanamo to cover these trials. And
now, you were part of the Office of Military Commissions doing that, right?
That's correct.
And where were you living at the time?
I was living in Pentagon City. Actually, I'll tell you a funny story about that. I was living in the same high rise that, remember the Russian spy ring with the redhead
Anna Chapman yes. In the tent.
I used to see her and her buddies around the pool at the place I was staying at, and I was like, whoa, you know? And then one day I come back from one of my adventures, and here's a bunch of FBI raid jackets walking in collecting stuff. And then the next day I hear they just rolled up a big spy ring living in the building I was in. It was pretty funny.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was funny.
They were part of the Russian intelligence SVR. That was, I think, called Operation Ghost Stories. That was one of the longest. They were all Russian illegals here, what we would call non-official covers. Yeah.
What years were you doing the Office of Military Commission thing?
That was in 2010. That was in 2010.
And did you work out of the office there in Tysons?
No. I worked in Alexandria on Wilson.
And the reason I'm asking, do you remember the general that was in charge of it back then?
Mm-mm.
One no. star.
I worked for a JAG officer, a Marine colonel.
But, and here's the reason I'm asking these questions. I sound like a defense attorney here trying to grill.
Well, you sound like an interrogator. Now, where were you on this night, and what were you wearing?
Because in, I want to say 2014 to 15 for 1 year. I only did it for 1 year. My buddy did it for 2 years. Tom Slovenki, he's a retired DEA agent. We were picked up on a contract to go work in the Office of Military Commissions there in Tysons, and actually where the general is and the prosecutors and all that. And the initial project was to review all the cases in Gitmo, which sounds exactly like what you were doing down there.
Well, in actual fact, though, I was on the other side of the table. I actually was working for the defense, which was fascinating. Oh.
We got to end the interview.
That's it.
Interview's over.
No, it was actually really fascinating because obviously my entire career I've been on the other side, and in this particular instance I was working with the JAGs that were on the defense side and some civilian attorneys. So it was very, very interesting, really fascinating.
Couple questions about that. Because it has taken forever. I mean, the military in some ways is really good because if they have to, they can move stuff. But when it comes to the legal process, we've been dicking around with this for 20 years, ever since Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was caught and had his ass renditioned back to Pakistan. I mean, we can't get a trial, and it's been 20 years.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things when Tom and I went into this position. And we started doing our research, and we were waiting to get our special security badges so we could go to Gitmo and do all the things that needed to be done. We realized that some of those detainees at that time had been in custody for 14 years. You know, we went to the general. It's like, what is it you think that we're going to find that you don't already know about? You know, he's the chief prosecutor. I wish I could remember his name. He was a super guy. I love the guy to death.
Well, the people I met were pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, we eventually, after we realized, you know, you're just spinning your wheels, we came up with another plan involving ISIS and
well, it's all politics, as you well know. It's all politics.
Did you get a chance to meet any of the original 9/11 conspirators?
No.
If you had, could you have just tossed a grenade in there and just sped along the wheels of justice?
Come I didn't on, have that with me.
Look at what I dropped.
Did you participate in any waterboarding events, Dana? Come on now, Gary.
No.
Enhanced, Murph, they're called enhanced interrogation techniques.
I got it. Did you meet KSM?
No, I didn't. I worked with people who worked with him, but I did not meet him.
I mean, these are some legitimate, bona fide, worldwide, international terrorist badasses.
Well, look, you're not in Gitmo unless number one, you get there. Obviously, renditions involved, but I mean, you had to be a military combatant, but you had to be high value enough to where it made sense to put you in Gitmo.
Right. Exactly. I was there. I was working on that assignment. For a company for about 7 months. And then an opportunity presented itself to bring me back to LA and for the same company. So I did that, and I did that for 2 years. And I worked for the Long Beach Police Department, Office of Counterterrorism.
For that company or as an actual?
For that company.
So you were a contractor back into
Precisely.
Them to do that.
Yes. Yeah. And I love that. I love the guys that work
like
with.
A man tech or, you know, somebody, these folks that do a lot of that kind of work. So
now
we see them a lot. We see them out there a lot.
I don't think that this company is around anymore. They were pretty big for a while, but I think that as they all do, I think it got bought by another company and the name has changed.
They do. They all consolidate.
Correct.
But
correct.
But you moved coast to coast. So you went from California, you went to Virginia.
Right.
And then, where did you, said you lived in Pentagon City. Anywhere else did you do where you lived out here in Virginia?
Well, initially I lived in, an awful place on Wilson Boulevard, but it was really close to where the office was, but it was awful. And, so an opportunity presented itself in Pentagon City, and there was a really great Irish bar across the street called, Slante. You guys know it?
Slante.
Yeah, Slante. And DEA's museum is nearby there, a few blocks away from there in Pentagon City.
DEA's museum is next to a bar, close to a bar. Who would have thought?
Well, not quite, but close enough.
Drunk every afternoon. What do you expect? You know, that's right. we got a reputation to live up to here.
But so I came back and worked that for a couple years, and then my name was sent over to. By one of the people I worked with on the detainee cases, was sent to some friends of theirs at SOCOM, and then I went to work at SOCOM for about 6 months, and then I came home. And
what was it, just a TDY, or did when you went to SOCOM, Special Operations Command down in Tampa? So what? By the way, I got an interesting aside for you. So in 2012, I was the senior law enforcement advisor for the Republican National Convention. Mm-hmm. Several of us got brought over to CENTCOM, mm-hmm. which is at MacDill.
Right. That's where I was. Right.
Yeah. For a class, we had classified briefings and all that good stuff. But we got to do something to this day. You talk about giving shivers. We were brought into what's called the CPOC, the Central Point of Command, and they were showing us, here's what we do, here's how we manage stuff around the globe, because CENTCOM, you have all the different commands, AFRICOM, CENTCOM, PACCOM, you know, all these different things. So, but we got brought into what's called the FPOC, the Forward Point of Command, and it's like, okay, I've told this story before to a couple others, but it's like, oh, this is going to be cool. We brought in, he said, show me which phone, because out of the desk came up this, if the desk was flat until you hit a button, and then out of it came banks of computers and phones and everything. That's where they launched Operation Neptune Spear from. And I said, which phone? And he pointed it to it. I touched the phone. That's the raid to get bin Laden. So when they eventually got bin Laden, it was launched out of CENTCOM there in MacDill.
Yeah. Yeah. And Admiral McCraven was the commander at SOCOM when I was there.
I forget who was the commander. I met the deputy commander, Major General Carl Horst. We got the challenge coins from him, but I was trying to think who the commander was. But yeah, but this was, I mean, like you say, it's awesome to think, you know, think about that stuff. But why 6 months? Was that just you decided that was enough, or had it run its course, or did you stay longer?
I was tired of being away from home. I really wasn't loving what I was doing. I was kind of, frankly, I was kind of bored with it. I needed to be home, and that was it. And an opportunity came up that would allow me to work from home with the company that I currently work for, the Greece Police.
Like in GREASE, the Greece Police, or the Greece, CREE, the country of Greece Police?
No, it's GREASE. I work for Darling Ingredients International, corporate security for them.
See, I was joking with you, Greece Police.
Yes, indeed. But we euphemistically call it the Greece Police.
I want to translate that statement you said where, you know, you needed to be home. Translated, that means your wife called you and said, honey, enough of this shit. Get your ass home.
Kind of. Actually, somebody else called me and told me, you need to get home. Your wife needs you. And I said, okay, because I'm not really digging this anyway. So, you know, and my wife and family need me. So let's go. And that was it.
Hey, so, couple things before we talk about your book. I want to ask you, when you came back from Iraq, what was it like to land back on U.S. soil?
Oh my gosh. It was incredible. But it was exhausting because it was this marathon trip. It was on again, off again, typical military operation, hurry up and be standing in formation at 0500 and wait. And then at 1700,
hurry up and wait.
Exactly. And at like 1700, 1800, they go, oh, you know what? The flight's been scrubbed. Come back tomorrow at 0500. And then you sit around, wait. And then finally you get loaded on buses and they take you to Kuwait City Airport and you get on the big plane. And we flew to Leipzig, Germany, and then Bangor, Maine, and then is it Fort Dix in New Jersey?
New Jersey, yeah.
And then Fort Benning. Fort Benning, yeah. And then you turn in all your gear and go through the out processing and all that. And they wanted me. And I was exhausted, but they wanted my sister lived in Greenville, South Carolina, and she was going to pick me up. But unfortunately, something happened and she couldn't pick me up. So I didn't have a ride. So this young captain, female captain who was processing everybody, she says, sir, I'm sorry, but I can't let you go because you don't have a ride here. And I said, Captain, I'm out of here. I ain't spending another night on an army base. I'm done. Goodbye. And I said, can you just get me somebody to the airport so I can pick up a rental car? And I did. And that was a long drive from Columbus, Georgia to Greenville, South Carolina, but I made it in one piece. But it was so strange because everything was green and I hadn't been around green like that in a long time. And it was just so surreal. It took a long time to get used to it. It really did. It was very strange. And I had a cough for a while too, from breathing all the dust and crap, you know? And
so many people have developed stuff. Hey, well, let's end on a fun note because you said you started your book back like around 2008. And let's talk about your book because it was just published, as they say, published, and you and I were talking books, Outside the Wire, published August 30th, 2022. And now let me just read a little bit of the cover of the book so people know what we're talking about and see let me think where the idea for this book came from. Outside the Wire vividly portrays the story of Rick Sutherland, retired LAPD detective lieutenant, now serving in Iraq as an embedded civilian counterterrorism advisor, and Major Nancy Weaver, an army doctor. When Rick is wounded in a mortar attack, he meets Nancy, and after a few missteps, a relationship develops between them. Nonetheless, they risk everything, including their burgeoning romance, while battling clandestine Iranian operatives bent on the slaughter of thousands of innocents and ultimately the destruction of America. It's a race against time. Let me think where you might have got the idea for this book from.
I can't imagine. I think it was a trip to Disneyland. But the genesis for this story was one day I was walking back to my hooch from the chow hall, and during that sitting with some other guys, I'd heard that there had been another suicide on the base. And I was aware of an attempted homicide at another FOB, forward operating base. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if a retired detective such as moi was brought in to help with a multiple victim homicide investigation, like a 10 Little Indians kind of thing, Agatha Christie kind of mystery. And I brought that idea home with me and quickly decided that that wasn't the idea I wanted to go with, that I wanted to make it an international terrorism story. And so that's what it is.
Well, did your wife have questions about, you know, somebody in your position and Nurse Nancy, Major Nancy, the doctor?
Who's this doctor again?
Hey, everybody, I read the book and I'm telling you right now, I highly recommend reading this book. It's an easy read. It's a quick read. It will keep you interested. It's a nice plot in there. There's some surprises that I'm not going to tell you about, but you need to find out about Nurse Nancy.
Dr. Nancy Weaver, MD. Yes.
Major doctor, yes. Nurse Nancy.
Major doctor. Well,
was Major doctor a major problem when you got back home?
No, in actual fact, no. It was not. That was all fiction. There's a lot that did happen to me that is in the book. Many of those things did happen to me. I did get Saddam's revenge, and I did meet a doctor, and she called it bubble guts, but she was, that was as far as it went. She was a lovely person and very funny and very nice, but, you know, that was, so there were a lot of things. There's a lot of the book that was drawn from my own experiences there. But it is a novel.
I was just wondering that when your wife read the manuscript, she said, "Honey, you got some spleen in here."
Exactly. Yeah. No.
But you know, it is the you know, and what I like about the book is you put in a lot of the intricate bullshit rules that the military has.
Oh my
for
God.
Civilians.
Oh Lord.
And it is just outrageously ridiculous.
Oh my God. I'll never forget one day I'm in a mess hall over at Camp Stryker, and I'm with some of the guys I work with, and you know, I'm in Army combat uniform, and I have an M9 Beretta on my hip. But it is unloaded as per the regulation. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, of course, I know.
Nothing strikes terror into the hearts of, attackers is knowing you have an unloaded weapon. Yes.
Well, exactly. Which is probably
you could load
why,
it, though. Yeah.
Which is probably why you have so many of these blue-on-blue attacks, because the guys are walking around with empty weapons, which is just, like, so stupid. But in any event, this E5 comes up to me and he says, your weapon's off safe. And I'm thinking to myself, Why are you looking at me that hard? And B, you know, why do you care? The damn thing is unloaded. The magazine well is empty. I mean, it's just dumb. It just really is dumb. We were cops for, decades and decades. We're used to carrying a gun all the time, and to be told that when you're in a combat position, you're in a combat zone, that you have to walk around and on a base shared by Iraqi army people, who one of which actually pointed a Dishka, which is, the Russian equivalent of a 50 caliber machine gun, at me when I'm in my PT gear, zero threat whatsoever. The guy's grinning at me. He trains a Dishka on me as they're leaving their little compound I mean, what the hell, And
I bet he had ammo though, didn't he?
Oh, he certainly did. It was locked and loaded. I saw those funny little copper things looking at me in the breach of the action of the weapon. So yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, there was a myriad of bizarre things that I went to a targeting meeting one time, and I'll never forget this. It was like, okay, this is cool. I'm going to go to a division targeting meeting. We're going to talk about blowing bad guys up and all this stuff. And they're talking about chickens and water. I shit you not. Chickens and water.
Was this code for something?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Maybe sadly, it was not. It was not. And it was bizarre.
I guarantee you, attorneys have come up with this plan.
Yeah,
wow. Because I went to a meeting in SOCOM it was Tom Slavinky and I. We were the only two non-attorneys in a whole room full of attorneys for 2 or 3 days, listening to them make decisions on how you run a war. And it is the scariest thing I think I've ever heard in my life. God bless our troops out there. You can be under fire, I mean, taking rounds, and there's air support that could respond within less than 60 seconds, and they've got to get permission from an attorney before the air support
can come.
It was unbelievable.
That's the biggest problem, too, they had over at the agency with people and other folks in the intelligence community. Nobody wants to take a risk anymore because attorneys are waiting to hoist somebody on their own petard, and make examples out of people. It's like, because they are so risk averse. Well, God, you're in a combat zone, or you're trying to run ops against the Russians and the Chinese. There is this thing called risk. You need to be able to take risks, so you can get the ultimate rewards.
I mean, can you imagine these kinds of restraints in a global conflict like World War II? Do you think things like people were even considering something like this back then?
I guarantee you there was no attorney on Eisenhower's staff when they were thinking about D-Day.
My God, no. I mean, it's just –
can you imagine if there
was,
though? Well, we got it. I think one of them would have been shot and thrown out and said, oh, look, accidentally shot himself 5 times in the back. Yeah.
I think, Murph, I think you're 100% correct that it's the lawyerization of the military, lawyerization of law enforcement, that is really a problem. You know, it costs lives. People lose their lives because of it.
And the public will never know. That's
and the public will
part.
Never know.
Well, if they listen to Game of Crimes, they'll know.
They'll know, by God, you listen to us. So, hey, look, guys, this is as we get in our new format. We're going to bring this to an end because we're trying to keep these things around an hour, make them easy for you to consume. But let me tell you what, you got to go to our website. Okay, so here's what you guys do. You don't go anywhere, Gary. You just hang on there, right? So we hope you guys enjoyed that. Head on over to our website, though, because we're going to post his book up there, and you're going to be able to get to it. You guys got to read it because he's also got a script option. So we need to make sure that he gets visibility on that. So head on over to Apple and Spotify, get those 5 stars, right, Gary? That just tell them they have to hit the 5 stars. You don't know why, just tell them they have to do it.
5 stars, right? 5 stars.
5 stars, right? Head on over to gameofcrimespodcast.com, our website. Like I said, that's where we're going to put his book up there. And I'll tell you what, if you're not reading his book, if you're not reading Outside the Wire, you need to be. You need to be. So go
it's
there.
It's an excellent book. And then we need to put his website up there too. So people
we'll put
can
it
follow.
Gary Edgington author. So GaryEdgingtonAuthor.com. You can go to, but that'll all be in our webpage there. So follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. And go to PayPal. But where you got to be, I'm telling you, and where you got to be too, Gary, where do you got to be, Murph? Where do everybody have to be to get not only this content, but even better content?
Oh, you got to come over and check us out on Patreon. There's a ton of extra comment over there that our content, I'm sorry, probably more than we have on a regular.
Well, we have comment
show.
And content. We comment on our content.
Oh yeah, we've got a lot more comment on that. So a lot of things that we don't normally say on a regular podcast, but it's everything from we're rating cop movies to we're having episodes on You Can't Make This Shit Up, which is some of the hilarious, most hilarious
and
stuff.
And speaking about
here.
A year ago, we rated for Christmas, the greatest Christmas movie ever made, Die Hard. And we actually had one of the guys from LAPD SWAT.
Yep.
Rick Massa. Who took down the North Hollywood bank robbers. We came on, we did the real analysis of Die Hard. And this month it's going to be Clint Eastwood. So we got some Clint Eastwood movies to talk
about.
Cool.
Yeah. Oh, Dirty my God.
Who? Yeah. Dirty Who?
So, Dirty Harry.
But come and check us out. Check us out on Patreon. See what you like. See what you don't like. Let us know what your comments are. Just because we don't agree with what each of us says doesn't mean we have to be enemies. So come on over and check it out.
Yeah, but you want to agree with us after listening to us. You realize we were right all the time.
Yeah, you'll feel sorry for us and you'll want to
so
stay.
So patreon.com/gameofcrimes. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. One more time if you're on Quaaludes. Patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Head on over there and have fun with us. But hey, look, we couldn't have done this without our special guest. Not a guest, but our special guest. Gary Edgington, I mean, cop extraordinaire, super secret agent, doing stuff we don't know for who, really, but he's over there in Iraq, you know, SOCOM coming back. But hey, good luck on your book, Outside
thank
the
you.
Wire.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being a special guest, and thank you guys for playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the original, unadulterated, and always special Game of Crimes.